You're listening to a Comics XF podcast.
Matt Lazowitz, and welcome to this week's episode of Bat Chat with Matt and Will, a Batman ranking podcast, where each week my co-host Will Nevin and I dig into three Batman stories, discuss them, and rank them on the big board, thus creating a giant list of Batman stories from best to worst. Will, what's going on tonight?
Matt, I have consumption.
I am not well.
So forgive me, dear listeners, for any of the snorts and throat clearings and just general grumbles I might have tonight, but I do have a problem, that is more serious than whatever passing contagion this is. So Facebook, right? Facebook is the cesspit of social media because it's like Twitter, but with boomers. Like if the social media could be worse, it's with boomers. But I have to use Facebook because I organize events here in the local running community. And we've just figured out the only way you can do that is on Facebook because everybody's there. And you just put, hey, this is where we're going to be this week. Go there. Let's see how many people we're going to have, you know, whatever. And so I'm on Facebook to do that. And I'm also on Facebook because, well, I mean, I don't want to be left alone at any point during the day with my thoughts. So, you know, I split my time between Twitter and Facebook because Facebook wants to be so much like TikTok, which I am not on. TikTok is for the youth. I am almost 40 years old. Not going to do that. Same thing with Snapchat. Mm-mm, fuck that. Facebook, though, desperately wants to be TikTok because TikTok is young and cool. Facebook now has this thing where it's called Reels because, you know, you can't just call it TikTok videos. And they show you reels very prominently. And you don't choose which reels you want to look at. Facebook just decides what reels it wants to show you. And I know the way the algorithm works. Like the reels I click on are more reels that I get. So, you know, it started showing me like I took a big hit of DayQuil before I came in. So my mind's a little fuzzy. So the hydraulic press videos, right? Like just like a slinky getting squat hydraulic press. You know, you click on that and you get 10 more hydraulic press videos. Not a problem. I click on a channel that does nothing but red hot steel balls being dropped onto stuff. Oh, let's get this metal ball red hot and drop it in Jell-O. See what happens. Let's put it on an orange. See what happens. Surprisingly, fruit exterior, tough as shit. Orange holds up. Melon holds up. Everything else, not so good. Although the Jenga tower worked out pretty well also. So, again, you know, watching my steel ball videos. At some point, I made a wrong turn. I did something bad because, Matt, the last couple of videos I've been getting are just fart videos. They are just compilations of people farting. And I'm like, yeah, I know I clicked on it, but that doesn't mean I deserve it. And I know I keep clicking on it. Why are people out there making this content? That is just nothing but a compilation of world's worst farts as caught on Ring cameras. I don't, why is anybody out there farting into a Ring camera? What's wrong with society? I don't understand.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Masterpiece Theater. I just need to know, are you going to attempt to one-up yourself each week with this content? Or is there a point where you're going
to
just kind of...
I'm coming to you with real problems, Matt.
Hey, the reels that I get on Facebook are all cats. Cats of various shapes and sizes. And Skeletor going, remember! And then some random weirdness. Because
I've gotten a couple of cat videos. I need to watch more cat videos so I stop getting these goddamn fart videos.
There you see that. There, that is my advice. My advice is cat videos. Because most of my, I just continually click on cat videos. And then when other things invade the algorithm, I just make sure to not click on those and click on more cat videos. I currently am getting regular content from a baby tiger at a zoo who is freaking adorable. He just sits around with his paws that are too big for his body and his little tiger tongue sticking out. It's freaking cute. So that's what you got to do.
You see, I think I know where this started now, because I remember I clicked on a couple of dog videos and it turned out it was dogs farting. And then we went straight from dogs farting to people farting. God damn it.
Cats. That is the solution to your problem. Cats.
So that's what's going on, Matt. I'm sick and Facebook has been feeding me fart videos.
That's a hell of a week, man.
I know.
But we're not just here tonight. We got a guest.
We got a guest. I got to put on pants.
This week, we're celebrating 300 episodes of the other podcast I co-host. And so we have that show's creator, the editor-in-chief at ComicsXF, and to quote previous Bat Chat subject Kevin Smith, my hetero life mate, Dan Grote. How's it?
Hey, it's me.
Welcome back to the person who was our first guest back on episode 5.
Whoa. And that's a lot of episodes ago.
Yeah, frankly, the shtick has not changed too terribly much in 120 something episodes.
But it's been amazing to listen to this show for 120 six plus episodes or whatever it's been. This is, you know, one of my favorite things that I listen to all week, and not just because this podcast airs on my website.
You get me. Get me right here, man. It's good to have you back, Dan.
It's good to be here.
Tonight, because we're celebrating 300 episodes of the podcast formerly known as WMQ&A that we'll have some sort of name change announced by the time this episode drops. We're workshopping that. So,
I can explain that. This is actually the first time I've explained this publicly. I haven't actually said anything anywhere except to Matt. At I believe episode 299. That's going to be the last episode of a podcast called WMQ&A, which started in like January 2018 with me, Matt, and our friend Rob just sitting in my basement talking about toxic fandom. And then from episode 300 on, and folks, as Will likes to point out, Bat Chat records like 15 weeks in advance, so you know the future is fungible. It will just be called the ComicsXF Interview Podcast, because why, God, why have I allowed this mess of alphabet soup to continue for as long as I have?
I will say, I think the best reaction we ever got was when we had Chris Sims on, who hadn't looked up what it meant. And he was like, just got to make sure this isn't like White Men's Quarterly or anything, right?
He did say that, and that's not what it is. No. For folks who don't know, I started a column at the Press of Atlantic City back in 2015. It was called Wednesday Morning Quarterback because that's the day the comics come out, and also sports. And so that's what it stood for. And then when I went and made my own site, WMQ Comics, you may remember it. It doesn't exist anymore. You know,
I remember it.
Yeah, you were there. Fun fact, another of the people who used to write for the site just messaged me the other day and was like, where'd it go? I'm like, yeah, whoops, sorry. I stopped paying for the domain for a dead website. But anyway, when the merger with ComicsXF happened, I kept the name of the podcast for a long time because I was like, well, I just don't want to mess up the SEO. It becomes a sunk cost fallacy after a while. And then sometime last year, I put in a colon and the ComicsXF Interview Podcast. So I'm like, this is going to be my way of gently transitioning to a new name. So here we are.
Yes. But this week, provided there is no Michigas, episode 300 of the ComicsXF Interview Podcast will be hitting. And so we decided to do a little celebration over here. So we are going to be reading three stories from creators who have appeared as guests on that show. We have had lots of bat-related guests, actually, in the long run. but I picked three that had the easiest access to stories. Because as much as I would love to cover the Rom V Detective Comics run, that's a big undertaking and it's not done yet. So
no.
We still have time on that one.
It might be done by the time you're listening to this.
We don't record.
I hope the ending was good.
But we are starting out with The Darkest Night of the Man-Bat. This is Batman Volume 1, numbers 536 to 538. The writer is Doug Mensch, with pencils by Kelly Jones, inks by John Beattie, colors by Gregory Wright and Android Images, letters by Todd Klein, and edited by Denny O'Neill and Jordan B. Gorfinkel. The cover dates are November of 1996 to January of 1997. Driven mad by events beyond his control, Man-Bat has fled to the North Pole, with Batman on his heels. Stumbling into a secret government lab, Man-Bat is growing more feral. Batman must save him and administer the cure before government agents kill Man-Bat. The guest in this case was Kelly Jones, who appeared in October of 2023 in episode 280 of then WMQ Comics. There will be links to each of these episodes in the notes for this episode.
Before we get into the story itself, can I tell the behind the scenes story of Kelly Jones coming on the show?
Please.
So every year we do a Halloween special, or we try to do a Halloween special. And we had planned one dating to the 2022 Halloween special. This was a Dracula special. This one was going to be a werewolf special. You know, we started the research and everything. Come to find out, Matt Wagner and Kelly Jones are dropping a Dracula Kickstarter right around Halloween. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, these are like, you know, if I could get these guys for the show, flip. So I reach out to their publicist and I'm like, hey, what can you do for me? And it turns out they were able to book them, you know, and it was going to be the day that we record for the Halloween special. So I kind of had to like, you know, I reached out to our friend Rob, who always does the Three Amigos specials with us. I'm like, I got to scrap everything. This is too good to pass up. And he gave his blessing. Thank God, Rob, if you're listening, we love you. And that recording made Matt very happy, if I recall correctly.
It absolutely did. Getting to talk some, not just Dracula, but some Batman, some Grendel. That was a good time.
Some Batman Dracula.
Yep. But here we are with another of the Mensch Jones arcs. I picked this one mostly because it's Kelly Jones drawing Man-Bat. So that's right in his wheelhouse of characters to draw.
Now, this is going against the backdrop of some event that we've already read, correct?
Final Night, yes.
Okay.
Where the Sun Eater envelops the sun and Earth is freezing. The first part of this is a crossover with Final Night. So there's a lot of talk about the sun is out and the world is freezing and Gotham is still a cesspool. Because the world might be freezing, but guys got to still get their drugs.
Yeah, if the sun has stopped coming up, I think that would be the only thing anybody would be talking about. So that was the only strange thing in the first chapter here.
Yeah. But also, if the sun has gone out, there's zero reason not to spend all your money on all the cocaine you can get your hands on.
Hey, that's very true.
For a bear.
That's yes. Right. But like, why even spend money anymore? Just take the cocaine.
The hope that the sun will eventually, maybe hopefully, come back and you really want to keep a good relationship with your coke dealer?
Yes.
The issue with crossovers like this is that why is Batman in Gotham dealing with this when he should be and was also technically in Metropolis working with all the big brains on getting the sun rekindled?
Oh, yeah, that was just a great line. I was like, yeah, I hope Superman fixes the sun.
There is a little bit, there's a bit of Wolverine syndrome to it, right? Where it's like, well, Logan's got to be everywhere, but also he still has a solo book that he has to appear in. But I actually didn't think that the crossover was that intrusive into the story, right? They get it out of the way in the first issue, and then by the second issue, it's like, Okay, well, the nerds and the cosmic guys fixed the sun thing, but we still have this man-bat problem, and he's going where it's going to stay dark anyway. So we can kind of just keep playing on that motif.
And thus we get man-bat in the thing, kind of.
Yeah, definitely thing vibes.
It was not a terribly intrusive crossover, and it was a good use of the event to springboard a story versus some crossovers that we've all read, or Dan and I have, since, Will, you don't tend to read as much superhero stuff outside of this, where we've seen the crossovers in the book where it's like the writer is clearly like, I don't want to be dealing with this shit. Why do I have to? I'm trying to think of the anything that Peter David wrote during X Factor where it was like Secret Invasion. It's like, I don't want to be writing Secret Friggin' Invasion. Why am I involved in this thing?
Now, I will tell you some shit that didn't work. The last chapter, when we just get this entire page of exposition about this stupid government energy Tesla weapon that I'm just like, I don't care. It's not Man-Bat. I don't care. And it's not even all that integral to the story.
That is a Mensch thing, because Mensch was the Fox Mulder of the Bat offices. He loved conspiracy theories. He'd written more than one story set around a conspiracy theory. And the HARP project, which is what this is using, was a big conspiracy theory in the 80s and 90s. If you look it up on Wikipedia, because I was familiar with it, I'm pretty sure it might have been even from an X-Files, but I know I'd read about it somewhere before, although it might have been in this comic first, and then I read about it somewhere else years later. But it was a whole thing, and the connection of Tesla to the Tunguska explosion in Russia in 1908, again, something I'd read about in some other conspiracy theory. We've said this before, I think, on both shows, but remember when conspiracy theories were fun?
Now they're all racist and bad.
Yeah, this was when conspiracy theories were, oh, the government is trying to create Nikola Tesla's death ray in the Antarctic. And there's at least one mention of Hollow Earth, which, you know, in the DC Universe is a thing. It's Skartaris, where Warlord hangs out. Not just in Neil Adams comics. We will get there someday to Batman Odyssey. Don't worry.
Okay, so the mention of Hollow Earth here, though, made me think there is currently a Justice League versus Godzilla versus Kong comic that is out. And the modern movies have Kong living in, like, Hollow Earth, I guess now hanging out with his friend Godzilla and teaming up to do crimes. So,
oh, I've got my ticket for the new Godzilla Kong movie on Saturday on IMAX. Oh, yeah. I have a soft spot because the first Godzilla versus Kong, or I think it was the fourth or fifth movie in this whole monster universe, that was my first movie back to the theaters after getting my COVID shots for the first time. So now it's like, oh, that was a good time. Get back out to the movie theaters and watching a big monkey fight a big lizard. If there was a movie to go out and see on the big screen, at that point it was like, yeah, monkey versus lizard.
My first movie back was Spiral.
Oh.
That was a Saw spinoff or like reboot or something, right?
Yeah. That Chris Rock punched up in not good ways. It's a bad time.
Yeah, I could see why that would be a rough first movie back.
I did that, and then 2 days later, Promising Young Woman. Very different experiences. Both good movies in very different ways. But Man-Bat. So, I mean, the first part is the Gotham part. And it's just like, hey, final night's going on. Batman's looking for Man-Bat. Bullock's helping Batman look for Man-Bat. Man-Bat leaves Gotham. And then we get two issues of Man-Bat in the Arctic with scientists and Batman trying to get up there and a bunch of literally nameless government troubleshooters. There's a lot of characters in here who have minimal personality.
My thoughts on the last two parts of this were they could have been one part. Part one, the final night tie-in. Part two, the thing in the Arctic.
Yeah. It could have been either compressed down to one part or used the real estate of two parts better to make me care about these scientists. because they at least have names, but none of them really get much personality until part three. And even then, not a lot. At least in part three, it's like, okay, so this guy was the mad scientist. She was the scientist who had a conscience. Mm-hmm. And then there's three other ones who are just kind of there.
Speaking of scientists with a conscience, this seems to be the most charitable characterization of Langstrom that I think we have read, either for the show or for the column, because he is very much portrayed as a tragic figure, like a heroic scientist experimenting on himself, and then it all just, you know, went to shit. Whereas we have seen other characterizations of more of the mad scientist type who is giving into this very willingly. This not so much the cannibalism and the you know, the eating and the whatnot, but just the general crime and vengeance.
This was actually probably from his introduction through the 90s characterization of Langstrom. When he was created, his origin here is his origin from those original Neil Adams drawn, I think Frank Robbins written stories. And he's used pretty regularly by Mensch and by Dixon throughout the 90s. And he's usually very much struggling with being Man-Bat. There's a good run of stories where he's more or less trapped as Man-Bat and is trying to find a cure, not just for himself, but he and Francine have a kid and his DNA has been all fucked up by being Man-Bat. So the kid is kind of Man-Batty. So he's trying to find a cure to also save his son from being a Man-Bat.
Now, you just mentioned Dixon. Interesting thing that popped up today. So, you know, I'm reading this on Kindle. And, you know, you get to the last page and then the author's bio popped up. And the little paragraph about Mensch, it gave him credit for creating Bane. And I just wonder where that comes from. Because that's literally like one of the few places where I saw his name mentioned in connection with Bane. While also I Googled, you know, creator of Bane, and like the first thing that pops up, not in like the search results, but according to Google's algorithm, Dixon, Nolan, and Mensch somehow.
I've always assumed that that was behind the scenes writer's room stuff, because Vengeance of Bane, I do not believe Mensch is credited as like a co-writer. It is just Dixon and Nolan, although I'm double checking that. Yeah, Vengeance of Bane number one is credited as Chuck Dixon and Graham Nolan. So my assumption has always been, because I've seen that listed as well in places, is that it was sort of bounced around and the concept, because, I mean, Mensch was the writer on Batman at that time. So I assume that the two of them worked on it together as they were setting up Nightfall, since they alternated chapters on Nightfall, so he gets a co-creator credit on it, despite Dixon actually writing the first appearance.
And Mensch presumably being much less of an asshole.
Yeah, from what I gather, Mensch is a kind of a weirdo, but not a bad guy. Just kind of a weirdo conspiracy nut. Which again, conspiracy nut in the 90s, not the same connotation as we have today.
Friendly weirdos like the Lone Gunman.
Right.
Yeah.
I agree that this story felt too long by a part. And it's not even like there were a lot of subplots that were taking up pages, because this was, again, the era, in the same way that, you know, to use a frame of reference that works better for you, Dan, that, you know, you got your Lobdell Nicieza X-Men era, where since the two of them had worked on it for so many years, like, okay, now we're going to pull away and we're going to do like four different cutaways before we get back to the main plot. That's what we got here, since you had Dixon, Grant, and Mensch each writing their respective bat book from 1993 through 1998-99. You could have had cutaways, you know, more stuff with the GCPD or this, that, but there wasn't even any of that, except for the occasional flash to Francine, who's worried about where Kirk is.
which reminded me, and this discussion reminds me, in talking about the presentation of Man-Bat, he's basically Batman's the Lizard.
Yes. I thought the same thing, and I tend to forget until I'm...
I don't want to cure cancer.
I think that's one of the reasons why they don't talk about Man-Bat's origin as much anymore, because it is a Spider-Man villain origin. It's not necessarily a Batman villain origin. Batman villains don't tend to have that kind of tragic origin. Their tragic origins are rooted in crime, like Two-Face, or even Freeze, where it's corporate greed. The villain who is a byproduct of science gone wrong doesn't necessarily fit in the oeuvre of the Bat villain. It is very much a Spider-Man villain thing. We said it at the beginning, but Jones throws the hell out of Man-Bat. He is big and scary and exactly what you'd expect of a Kelly Jones Man-Bat.
He's playing an interesting game with light and shadow throughout this story, which obviously a good story to play with light and shadow throughout. But, you know, you have a lot of characters who are sort of enveloped in darkness. Their faces are half hidden. And then you get these random panels where all of a sudden they're in the light. And Jones is very good at minimalist grotesquery, I almost want to say. Like, I'm not even thinking about Man-Bat here. I'm thinking about Harvey Bullock. The scene with him in the GCPD where he is just demolishing jelly donuts and the lights finally turn on and his just face is stained purple and he's got that don't bother me with my job look on his face.
I always loved Jones's Bullock is just on the good side of grotesque. He doesn't quite reach grotesque, but it's like if you just pushed him a little further, he would become something really unpleasant versus just kind of a slovenly bum of a man. I don't know if I have anything else.
Dan, you got anything?
I will just say, I think of the three stories, this is my story of the night.
Yeah, yeah. Not a hard choice tonight, I don't think.
I think the one that's the bottom is easier. I think the other two, depending on what you're looking for. But this is exactly what you got from 90s Bat books, or especially Batman, because each of the three books had a flavor. Batman tended to be Batman, you know, fighting villains, and it was very much a superhero comic. Detective, there was not a ton of gangster stuff in any of the books, but Detective at least had more of a detective-y sort of feel to it. And Shadow was the psychological, you know, we're looking at the villains, we're looking at the people of Gotham, and it's sort of how Batman ripples through this world. And so this is a really good example of what this book was in this era. But if we don't have anything else...
Oh, that means it's time for Darkest Night of the Man-Bat on the big board.
We are at 393 stories on the big board. God, we are very close to 400.
So close.
Number one is the post-crisis origin of Batman. Batman Year One.
Still hanging in there at a sexy 69. It's JLA Prometheus.
At 100 is Made of Wood, the Batman Golden Age Green Lantern team-up. At 200 is Sharkbite! The Deanie and Kramer Batman Riddler solve a murder on a boat story. At 300 is Bouncing Baby Boy, the Batman Plastic Man team-up. And at the bottom...
Hey, Joe Kelly!
At the bottom, at 393, it's... Frickin' War Crimes.
The nominative determinism strikes again!
All right. I'm thinking right around the middle of the list.
I think this squeaks above 200.
Yeah, I think it does, but I'm not sure. Let's see. So it squeaks above 200. I'm good with that. 175 is Batman Year 100, the Paul Pope Elseworlds. I don't know if it beats that.
Wouldn't beat the first Batman 89 volume at 180.
Okay. Yep.
Probably not. Love Slave of a Plant-Based Killer at 184.
Something in a similar flavor from a decade or so prior, but still. At 193, Nightmare in Crimson, the second monk story, the Bronze Age monk story with the Gene Colan art. I think this beats that. That's another one that's kind of oddly paced. But I think this works for me a little better. And I love Gene Colan. I think Gene Colan's a great choice for Batman. But I think Kelly Jones is the superior Bat artist. If we're talking superior Dracula artist, I think the edge might go to Colan. But for Batman, I think the edge goes to Jones.
Batman Annual number 1 at 191.
That is the Christmas annual, the five shorts. Tom King and David Finch with Ace, Snyder.
I have asked that question before. I remember this now. Diminishing yeah. Returns.
Yes, precisely.
I'll probably put this above that.
Yeah. And right above that is Penguin Affair, another three-parter, and we're creeping closer because that's like 89 or 90. That one has similar sort of issues where you've got the plot threads involving the soap opera star that the Penguin's in love with that never get really fully fleshed out
and feel
kind of like it's making time in there.
How about we make this the new 190 then?
Sure. Sounds good to me. New 190.
Didn't it be Longest Night of the Man-Bat?
Did I get it wrong?
No. You got it right. But I mean, like, shouldn't it be like the Longest Night of the Man-Bat?
Probably. Well, I guess it's playing on Dark Night of the Soul. So I think just to maintain the wordplay, they're doing that despite Longest Night probably making more sense. Your second story of the night is Who Would Win? This is Superman Batman Volume 1, number 78. The writers are Joe and Jack Kelly, with art by Ed Bennis, colors by Pete Pantazis, letters by Steve Wands, and edited by Eddie Braganza and Rex Ogle. The cover date is January of 2011. Two boys discuss one of the ageless questions. Who would win in a fight, Batman or Superman?
So Joe Kelly didn't come on my show, so I don't have to be nice to him.
But give me a sec, because we've got two things. I've got to both say, okay, so Joe Kelly is the guest, and he appeared on episode 241 of the Comics XF Interview Podcast, and Problematic Creator Watch, Eddie Braganza, editor and sexual harasser.
Sorry for stepping on you. No worries, Matt. But do you think Joe Kelly was like, finally, Deadpool. Finally. I'm so excited to write Deadpool. Because really, I've been writing Deadpool this entire time. I mean, this was probably my favorite Joe Kelly book that we've read because it was just so silly and I didn't have to pretend to take it seriously.
It's kind of one of the reasons why I thought this one might be the safest choice from the Kelly oeuvre, because it's shorter, it's punchy and silly. I did forget that it was only half the book. Not 100% sure. We might talk about that back up a little, but it's not going to weigh on the ranking any.
No, I didn't. Look, it wasn't written by Joe Kelly. I didn't read it.
And that's fine.
It's been a long week, Matt.
I don't need another Problematic Creator Watch, and I would have needed a different one for the second story. So, yeah.
Remind me.
Brett Booth.
Is that the Brett Booth? Oh, yep. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, we don't need to talk about that.
God, what a time looking at the creator list on this book.
Oh, that is a problem that sometimes you run into when you look at some of these books from the early aughts. Oh, was it Red Hood and the Outlaws where it had Lobdell, Braganza, and Booth all on one book?
Yeah, that sounds right. That's a tour de force of shit.
Yeah, yep. But yes, this story is very, very light. It's Joe Kelly and his son, apparently. That's Jack Kelly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's just 12 pages of two kids playing the, you know, who would win in a fight? Oh, well, Superman would do this. Well, Batman would do this. Well, Superman would do this. Well, Batman would do this. It's fine.
It's you know, it's sweet in its way, right? I think the fact that Kelly wrote this with his son says something. I like that it's from the perspective of these two, I don't know, 12, 13-year-old boys, whatever it is. It's sort of the classic comic shop debate of who win in a fight, which if you ask any comic creator, that the question itself is bullshit because the answer is, you know, whatever is narratively convenient. But if you take all that aside, you just focus on sort of the playground debate. Now, what I will say is these two kids that are having the argument are a little bit too savvy about comic book tropes because they're like, okay, well, there can't be like Starro involved or no magic. And also they're hip to it. They're in on the joke.
Hey, it's funny. Speaking of Facebook earlier, I don't know what I did in whatever the algorithm, but I must have responded to something somewhere because now my Facebook feed, aside from whatever, you know, pictures of my nieces and things, which is mostly what I go there for, is full of all of these groups that are, you know, Batman with prep time runs this gauntlet of heroes. Who would win? And it's like, I gave up caring about that kind of shit years ago. And you read the first comment and it's always either someone saying, well, Batman with prep time could beat anyone, or someone going, this is stupid. Batman's just a guy. It doesn't matter how much prep time he has. The first character in the gauntlet will beat him. Both
just,
of these.
Just the lowest order of content.
Yes.
I think whether we're talking about Batman or fart videos, no matter what, you know, the social media algorithm goes right to the lowest common denominator. And what I would say is in both of your cases, at least they haven't steered you to Nazi videos yet.
Very true.
First it's dogs farting, then it's people farting, and then it's Nazis farting.
You know, at least I haven't gotten the ad for the God Bless the USA Bible yet. So.
Oh, boy. Oh. On Twitter, I get Patriot Mobile ads.
Oh,
is that like burner phones for conservatives?
Hell yeah. The one cell phone company that's willing to stand up for the rights of the unborn. Patriot Mobile. I'm not even joking.
Oh, I know.
That shit
not.
Is real.
I know you're not. And again, one of these times where I wish this were a video podcast, just so you can see the selection of expressions on all of our faces.
Dan is horrified.
And I just can't.
So something that's good, which is not Patriot Mobile or the cesspool that Twitter has become. I do like, so the kids are narrating this hypothetical fight, but then also they're writing dialogue for Batman and Superman, and you know, they're kids, right? So it's like, it's snappy, punchy little dialogue. It's equivalent of like, you know, Superman says, well, fuck you, Batman. Batman's like, well, fuck you back. It's nonsensical, but it's funny. And it's a good contrast to see that on the page with this, you know, basically nonsensical dialogue.
And each kid keeps calling the other one out. Like, Batman doesn't talk that much. Yeah, but, you know, you can only go so long with him just grunting before it gets boring. Which, I don't think Kelly was necessarily taking a shot at a particular writer. But it's still a pretty good line about the way some people do write Batman. Because there is that happy medium. You don't need him be a modern Batman talking as much as, say, Adam West, but you also can't have him just be, you know, I'm trying to think where I saw Batman. There's some animated Teen Titans Go, where Batman never actually speaks.
Yeah, but then he and Jim Gordon have like sleepovers and they have that like ridiculous laugh that they do.
Yes, that is true.
The one thing I kind of, there's not much to this story, right? Either way. The one thing I kind of took quibble with is like the one moment where you get like Cheesecake Wonder Woman.
Yeah. While it could be argued that, oh, these are 13-year-old boys, it was an unnecessary moment. But it's also Ed Bennis. So Joe Kelly writing to his artist.
Again, it was an era.
Yeah. contrast, the moment that I really liked was the very end where the two kids are both like, oh, all of this is hypothetical because they're friends and this wouldn't happen. That's nice to read because there was an era. I mean, this is 2011, so this is later. But there was an era in the mid-80s through the early 90s where that was not the case, where these two guys were not friends, and they were pretty regularly sort of at each other's throats, or at least not getting along. Thank you, Frank Miller and John Byrne, for setting those precedents that it took Grant Morrison to get out of.
And we've
and then we end up going back to in the 2010s and in, you know, mass media and everything.
And
even the friggin' straight to video DC Lego movies.
Why did you say that, Dave?
And the New 52, where they also weren't getting along as we, you all, I'm editing that episode right now about Batman and Superman meeting for the first time in the New 52 and them just both being big old dicks to each other for a four-part story.
I did really like the stinger, the actual Batman and Superman showing up and, you know, kind of like, oh, this is an interesting little discussion we just snooped on.
Yeah, he was pretty close with some of that. What part? You know, you're kidding, Bruce. No, seriously, what part? The stinger was cute. And I get that's the word of this story. This is a cute little story. It falls in the same sort of range as Man-Bat's New York Adventure, a similar like six-page, like, oh, we're just going to do something.
You mean Batmite?
I said Man-Bat, didn't I?
Yeah, you did.
That would be a very different story.
Man-Bat's New York Adventure, totally different.
Yes, Batmite's New York Adventure. Now I kind of
want more cannibalism in the Man-Bat one.
I kind of now want somebody to write Man-Bat's New York Adventure, hanging out in belfries, maybe landing on the lions out in front of the New York Public Library,
eating the Mets.
I don't know if there's much more to say on this. I mean, it is just it's a slight story, and there's nothing wrong.
It's a trifle. All right, let's put this trifle to bed before I got to switch to NyQuil. Well, that means it's time to put Superman Batman number 78. Who would win on the big board?
All right, so I just said Batmite's New York Adventure. That's at 325. Up or down?
I'd go up.
That one... That has Michael Golden art, but I think that's really all that speaks to it. And again, I stand firmly by my theory now that that wound up in the greatest Batman stories ever told because you needed a certain page count, but you couldn't go too much bigger. So they needed something that was like six pages. I'm like, this one. Are you seeing an area where you're thinking, Will?
My internet cut out, or I could be having visions at this point. I missed the number.
Well, I started looking at Batmite's New York Adventure, which is now 325, and Dan said higher, and I agreed.
Yeah. Higher than 325. That is there primarily because it's so short, and I assume that's what you were referring to there.
Yes.
Let's see. I can find a ceiling.
You said that this is the best Joe Kelly story that we've read, which then puts it above 301 with Bouncing Baby Boy.
Absolutely. I loathed that story. And I would gladly reread this over that. It is shorter and it has less Joe Kelly Plastic Man.
Okay.
I might put a ceiling at Luther, You're Driving Me Sane at 273.
Yeah, I was gonna say I was looking a little, I saw 275 is like the first appearance of Catwoman, and I was gonna say I think I couldn't put this above the first appearance of Catwoman at 275. What about 285, Death by the Ounce, that Mr. Miracle, Brave and the Bold, with Granny Goodness looking for the Fountain of Youth formula?
I'd put it above that. Maybe just right above that, because you know what? enjoy the labor politics of Golden Streets of Gotham.
Okay. 285 it is. And our final story of the night is Nowhere Man. This is Batman Volume 2, numbers 19 to 20. The writer is Scott Snyder, with pencils by Greg Capullo, inks by Danny Meakey, colors by FCO Plasencia, letters by Comicraft, and edited by Mike Martz and Katie Kubert. The cover dates are June to July of 2013. The mysterious suicide of a business colleague of Bruce Wayne's leads Batman to a startling discovery. Clayface has mutated, now being able to mimic his targets down to their DNA. And Clayface has a specific plan for this new skill. Reveal the identity of Batman. The interviewed creator here is Scott Snyder, who's come on to the show twice, once in episode 125 and once in episode 200. So we are not quite 2 years into the new 52. We are really in the least connected to any of the big plots stories that Snyder had done up until this point. Because when you think about it, Snyder's run is 52 issues, but it's really five stories with one or two short little interstitials. Because it's Court of Owls, Death of the Family, Zero Year, Endgame, Super Heavy. And there's a one issue in between Court of Owls and Death of the Family, the Harper Row one shot. There's this two-parter and a one-off dealing with the ramifications of Damian's death over in Batman and Rob and Batman Inc. in between Death of the Family and Zero Year. And I think there's one issue in between the end of Zero Year and Endgame, a fill-in. And then it goes right from Endgame into Super Heavy. And then I think he writes one issue after, and I think it's Tynion who finishes that volume. I don't even think Snyder writes issue 52. I'm pretty sure it's Tynion. So this is just very much a remove from that. And I remember reading at the time that this was Snyder's equivalent of an episode of Batman the Animated Series. It's short, got a little bit of a hook to it of a mystery, and it's got a supervillain. It's not supposed to be as epic and sweeping as Court of Owls or Death of the Family was.
Okay, so I'm gonna say something in response to that. Darkest Night of the Man-Bat, right, is a final night tie-in. But you go into that in the first part, and they're like, okay, this is connected to a bigger thing. This is why Man-Bat is freaking out. And then it moves on, right? This, with this Clayface story, as somebody who did not read through the new 52, I've read Court of Owls and then kind of fell off, although I do have the trades for Death of the Family sitting on a bookshelf somewhere collecting dust. There were so many plot points that were moving through this that I just barely had the context for. Like, I was just like a little bit lost. I'm like, wait a minute, Robin's dead at this point? Have they done Zero Year? They're talking about Zero Year. That kind of stuff. This felt, of the three stories, the most heavily serialized.
And this is going to be a very stupid thing to say, but I'll say it. That's my job here. This is the most new 52. Because, right, we have an established villain like Clayface, and we just fuck with his, you know, his basic, I guess, MO, his basic, you know, character traits. Oh, he can mimic someone's DNA now. All right, let's see what we can do with that. And the answer is not much more than you usually do with Clayface.
And it fucks with his origin, because this takes Clayface 1 and Clayface 2 and sort of squishes them together to create a hybrid origin.
I see what you did there.
Yes.
Squishing Clayface together. Nice.
Yes. Because we won't go into all the Clayfaces, because that's a ridiculous amount of time. But most people, when they think of Clayface, think of Batman the Animated Series.
That'd be Matt Hagen.
Matt Hagen name, Basil Carlo backstory, Matt Hagen powers.
Which one was Matt Hagen? Which
Matt
number
Hagen
of Clayface?
Is two.
Okay.
So just for the frame of reference, in the comics, Clayface 1, Basil Carlo. In the original stories, silent film actor whose most legendary part, The Terror, or the most legendary film, was being remade as a talkie years later, and they didn't offer him the role. So he goes about killing people on the set. So he was the actor Clayface. He had no powers. He just, Clayface was one of the characters from one of his movies. He wore a clay mask. Boom. Clayface 2, Matt Hagen,
was a diver.
Treasure hunter and diver who found a magical pool of goo that when he submerged himself in it and came out, he had shape-changing powers.
Basically, once again, Dan making some quality faces here.
So,
imagine if you could read all of this in like a recap format. What a fun comic book that would be.
Multiple.
And we haven't even gotten through the other like three clay faces yet.
Yeah, no, we're stopping at one and two because that's pretty much where it goes now. I mean, ever since Basil Carlo eventually found a way to usurp the powers of the other Clayfaces and became just the only Clayface in the comics.
Aside from Lady Clayface.
Yes, Lady Clayface still shows up because she's a lady. Mm-hmm. And that makes her different. But Preston Payne and all the other Clayfaces have pretty much been kind of shuffled off to the side. And Matt Hagen, because he died during the crisis and was never heard from again.
Went back to his home planet.
I want to say it was Tynion during the Tynion run where Carlo tried to reform. You once saw him at an audition and he was using the name Matt Hagen as an alias. So that was a nice little nod.
Nice.
Yeah. So here we have, again, this, the way they describe his origin is, oh, he was an actor who had himself injected with experimental magical goo. So it kind of takes the two characters and creates a hybrid Clayface from them. And this all gets maybe not completely forgotten. Tynion plays some lip service to it during his run when he, again, tries to reform Carlo and gives him like a gauntlet that allows him to maintain his Basil Carlo form again. But that seems to be less about this DNA stuff that we get here and more about his inability to maintain a form for an extended period of time. Out of the Clayface origin morass and into this actual story. Yeah, I can completely see where you're coming from with the fact that you are just kind of being thrown into it and there's not even a, okay, well, Robin's dead. This is a guilt of the New 52 because DC desperately wanted people to be reading the entire line. Mm-hmm. By this point, it was a little less interconnected than it was for the first year. But that first year, at least also in that first year, they really liked using the classic, you know, asterisk, see this issue. That might not have hurt here to have an asterisk. Robin died in Batman Incorporated number 8. Would have at least given a little more reference for exactly what was going on.
This is right when we're starting to get Comixology as a thing. So you could be like, you can go buy this back issue on Comixology and read it.
And I'm sure Damian was whisked away immediately to a Lazarus pit.
You'll see. We'll get there. I don't want to give away any of the mishigas that goes on around the death of Damian. And when we possibly cover that story, we might have to get another WMQ previous guest, writer Nadia Shamas, to come on because she has very strong feelings about the way Talia was written during that whole back.
Matt, it can't possibly be that interesting.
You'll see. You've had your feelings about Morrison and they've been coming around.
So Morrison brings him back, is what you're telling me.
No, Morrison kills him. Tomasi brings him back in Batman and Robin.
Oh, okay. So Damian's death is part of the Morrison run.
Yes.
That's what you're telling me.
Yes, Damian's death is near the climax of the Morrison run.
Okay.
Yeah, no, that was something Morrison had not really relevant to this story. Because this story is more about the emotional fallout of Damien's death.
It's great examples of Bruce not wanting to grieve or reach out to people or rely on them, and so do the cold Bruce thing that Matt in particular doesn't tend to like. He was mean to Alfred.
Matt doesn't mind that for an arc or two, because he's not good with his emotions. And if he immediately decided to sit down with Clark and Diana and have a good cry, that would be more out of character. But we're 1 month, I think, out from Damien's death, because the issue before this, 18, was the Requiem issue, and Requiem ran, I guess, 2 months out from Damien's death. So I can completely buy him not being at a place where he's ready to talk about that. It's when that goes on for 8 months that it becomes obnoxious. Because no matter how much you learn about yourself and try to change some of those bad habits and emotional patterns that you have, your knee-jerk reaction is always going to come down to that first built-in reaction. Years of therapy have taught me this. And so you can give Bruce all the therapy in the world, but when something bad happens, his first instinct is always going to be locked down. Mm-hmm. And it's good that by the end of this story, I do like the last couple of pages where he does have a moment where he talks to Alfred about what is going on and what is different here about the way he's responding to the death of Damien versus how he reacted to the death of Jason Todd. Snyder always had a good feel for the Bruce and Alfred relationship. And so we don't get a lot of it here, but those are some of the better moments of this story.
Two things that sort of came to my mind while I was reading this. One is this was an incredibly science fiction-y run, at least compared to what we have now. And again, what we have now is, you know, fighting killer robots 95% of the time in Batman. But the trap that Clayface is eventually put in, like, you know, oh, it's keyed on, you know, Basil Carlo's DNA, which you conveniently don't have anymore. Aha. The VR headsets that Bruce and Alfred are wearing at the end, and they're, you know, watching what amounts to home videos of Damien. And then also, this was strangely dialogue heavy for Snyder, I thought. We got a couple of pages that are very talky, which seem to be not what I feel is Snyder's work. But this is still fairly early in the run, if early can be about halfway through.
Yeah, there's a lot of exposition here. There's a lot of talking about when the bit that cues Bruce into the mystery about the architect who committed suicide and that whole thing, and him talking to Alfred about that, talking about the architect. It's a lot of, let me tell you about this person because they're dead. And then a lot of talk about what's going on with Clayface.
A lot of talk from Clayface.
Yeah, Clayface is chatty. If this were being written with the original characterization of Basil Carlo in mind, that would work a little better, because the original Carlo was a ham. He was this actor, the version on Harley Quinn, that bombastic. I mean, he's more sinister because he's a serial killer, but that is actually pretty much how he works. I think it's the end of the Mud Pack, the one story you have with the different clay faces, where Batman basically beats him because he knows that these powers are going to start breaking down. And so all he's got to do is get him going, and he'll just monologue until the powers eat him alive. But this isn't exactly that Carlo. So it doesn't feel as natural that he's as chatty.
The note that I took about not necessarily the personality of this Clayface, but the science of what is happening to his body, is that it feels like when we get behind the scenes stories about Jared Leto going method, yeah, he really thinks he's Morbius.
Right. He's going to make people push him around in a wheelchair. I would not want to be on set. I mean, there's any number of reasons why I wouldn't have wanted to be on the set of the Suicide Squad movie where he was the Joker. But that one is a whole other level of why I wouldn't.
Morbin time.
The other thing that we see here is this is not the first, but this is yet another nod to Batman Beyond, which Snyder works through his entire run, because we see a Powers as a member of the Court of Owls during that arc. And then Jerry Powers buys Wayne when Bruce loses his money yet again during Eternal, and she's running Wayne during Super Heavy. So the fact that we see the Beyond suit, or a proto version of the Beyond suit here, fits with a lot of what Snyder is doing. I do like the fact that it's, you know, Lucius's comment about this won't be cost effective for another 20 years. Like, wah, wah.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, that came right after a direct ripoff of A New Hope and the trash compactor scene.
Oh, yeah. When he first dumps him in there, it's like, boy, it looks like the trash compactor from New Hope. Oh, wow, it really is the trash compactor from New Hope. This is right out of that scene. And that is a moment where if you're going to do that, you really need to hang the lampshade on it. Unless Star Wars doesn't exist in the DC universe, which, I mean, I guess it was owned by Disney at this point, so they probably couldn't talk about it. But still.
Quick, what's Warner Brothers' big sci-fi franchise?
They've been trying for a lot of years, and I don't know if they have one yet.
Wait, Space Jam?
No.
Okay, Dune,
Yeah, Dune, I guess, at this point would be, yeah. Batman is the Kwisatz Haderach.
Yeah, there you go. That is interesting, the idea of seeding Batman Beyond stuff in the present, especially, you know, if your next writer isn't going to pick it up. It's always like it's always like when X-Men tries to jump the gun on Days of Future Past.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was something that was going on a lot in the New 52, because I think DC really wanted to set up the Beyond future. McGinnis was a time-lost player during that weekly New 52 Futures End. It was a not terribly well-received weekly that was setting up Convergence.
Okay.
It was running at the same time as Eternal. And, it's multiple steps of time travel, because it's, okay, Terry McGinnis comes back in time to stop Brother Eye from taking over the world, but he doesn't make it back far enough. So he's going from like 30 something years in the future to 5 years in the future, where the events have already started. So he's now trying to fix it there, but it's not really working. So he's going to have to find some way to get back to the present. But there's all these other plots going on involving Mr. Terrific and Frankenstein and Tim Drake, who has been in hiding for the past number of years. And yeah, I'm just talking about it, I'm going all cross-eyed.
When did these books come out again? 19 and 20 here.
2013.
Aha, you were correct on the timing of the Star Wars sale, 2012.
I thought so.
We have to be factually accurate on this show.
The other big Batman Beyond references that were going on at this point were over in Gotham Academy, because Warren McGinnis, Terry's dad, was a student at Gotham Academy. So he was in high school at this point. And Jerry Powers makes some reference to her nephew, Derek. So I was like, yep. So you're setting up a lot of the Beyond stuff. Mm-hmm. And then nobody really picks it up. They try to do the... I can't. Because then when we get back into Future's End stuff with the canonicity of some of this other stuff. It was a mess. And yeah.
Well, let me pull focus here. Greg Capullo, great artist, doing a great job with a character who you can really get into some good body horror shit. which I think he does with Clayface. One question I had, though. So the bat plane in this story, why does it look like it has a giant bazooka cannon on the end of it?
Why would it not have a giant bazooka cannon on the end of it?
Batman, he doesn't use guns. But the bat plane always seems to have armament. And yeah, I mean, that's the 89 thing with Batman with two machine guns on the Batwing. That's
rule of cool and let it go. Got
yes,
it.
That's the answer.
It's a rubber bazooka, just like they were rubber bullets in 89.
Nets. It shoots nets.
Sure.
I loved the pages towards the end where Clayface and Batman are fighting and Clayface starts morphing other villains out of himself and they start talking at Batman. Mm-hmm. That's a great visual. And the second head that shoots out of Clayface Lucius Fox's mouth that attacks Bruce. That is some gross looking stuff. Capullo does a great job. His version of the Reaper in those opening pages with Damian. The Reaper is not a costume that works unless you were Alan Davis or Todd McFarlane. But I think this is the best Reaper I've seen that wasn't either of those guys. Not that a lot of people have used the Reaper, but it's a weird armory design that often falls flat. And I liked how it looked here. And it's a character that I was like, oh, I like that character. He's not one that pops up very often.
Capullo's doing the new Wolverine book. Isn't that right?
That's
a fever dream.
That's the rumor.
Yeah.
Ah.
Yeah.
I think that was on that like bleeding cool rumor creator list, but nothing's been announced to that end.
They're usually right about stuff.
He was partially right on what has been released so far, so we'll see.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be cool. I would probably read that.
That's a great pairing.
Yeah. So the final note on this one, I think, I really, because we talked about it a little bit, I liked the end where Bruce tells Alfred, because Alfred said earlier that he's concerned that he's losing himself like he did when Jason died, by, you know, looking at these recordings. And Bruce says to him gently that it's not that he's losing himself, it's that he's not ready to let go yet. And Alfred asks to join him and they watch and Bruce has a tear. Alfred just puts his hand on his shoulder and it really is that beautiful father-son relationship that Snyder captured in a lot of places and is the best part of Super Heavy. That Alfred's torment at having to see his son give in and lose the happy life because he has to do the right thing again. And Snyder is lays that out throughout this entire run. And that is a particularly good moment of Bruce and Alfred.
Well, we know that Bruce had to come back because Jim Gordon in a mech suit fucking sucked.
Wayne will always wind up being Batman again. In the same way that Steve Rogers will always wind up being Captain America again, and Clark Kent will always wind up being Superman again. The archetypal version of these heroes will always exist.
Until the series becomes unprofitable.
And then they will briefly become someone else until that becomes unprofitable, and then they'll be back.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it takes 20 years, freaking Barry Allen, he comes back. Okay, before I start complaining about Jeff Johns doing the Barry Allen thing,
I'm so close to NyQuil. All right, that means it's time to put Batman 1920 Nowhere Man on the big board.
So right now, Super Heavy is at 199, and Zero Year is at 222.
I agree with Dan that Darkest Night of the Man-Bat at 190 is the story of the night, because primarily this is a very basic-ass Clayface story. Aside from the art, I don't think we do anything interesting with Clayface here. So I would put this below 190, but strangely enough, probably above Super Heavy, because Super Heavy is so long. But I understand that that's a narrow range and we may need to play with that.
Because I'm just looking at that. And for instance, I would probably, and this is saying something, 197 when in Rome. That's six issues that probably A, reads faster than these two because it's very breezy. It's Loeb and Sale. And as good, and this is I think, a fallacy that might be, I don't think is by any means unique to me, but Greg Capullo is still making new art. As good as his work is, I will generally fall in favor of, say, a Tim Sale or a Darwin Cook, who we're not going to be getting any more of that art. And this is kind of like, you look at this as the peak of their creativity versus Capullo, who still is developing, still is changing. Even if his style has reached sort of a pinnacle, he still has things he can do with it. Again, I like the idea here about, you know, Clayface basically creating a giant blackmail pyramid scheme, but it's not done. It's not, nothing is done with it. It's just like, oh yeah, by the way, what really is going on is I'm blackmailing all these rich folk.
And the suicide angle is so odd, because certainly the guy would have some kind of alibi.
He right? does. Batman found it. He's like, oh, he wasn't even in Gotham when the crime that he was accused of committing happened. He had the flight logs.
Very strange.
Unless Clayface killed him, which was not clear.
Yeah.
Clayface killed him and made it look like a suicide. It could be read that way, but it was not clear one way or the other whether it was suicide or whether Clayface killed him and made it look like a suicide. And if it was the latter, why was he running around still in that form?
Oh, and such a trope with suicide too. Oh, he had so much to live for. I don't like writers trying to explore that kind of idea. But anyway, I mean, do you want to say 198? 199?
198 or 199? 198 is Mosaic, our most recent arc in No Man's Land, which was a lot of place setting for the next big set of events in No Man's Land.
That did have some nice Jim Gordon getting laid.
It did. And some good stuff with Barbara, even if it's a little hard on the character, it's moving her in a direction. Nothing
199.
Really. Yeah, because nothing really comes of this story.
You know, straight thought, but now that I'm thinking about sort of the blackmailing Richo's angle, there's a version of this where Clayface is almost seen as like a Robin Hood-esque hero that might have actually made for a more interesting story.
I think so.
Yeah.
Man, I'd read the shit out of somebody blackmailing Elon Musk.
Well, that does it for the night. Dan, thank you for coming on the show.
Absolute pleasure.
Tell people where they can find you online.
Don't find me. Find ComicsXF. Go follow ComicsXF on Twitter at ComicsXF and Blue Sky and Instagram and Facebook, all those places. And you know, support
Reels?
Our writers. I'm sorry?
Reels?
Reels? No, we don't have any Reels. No. No TikToks. Maybe someday.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe we got to get on that hot fart video algorithm.
Next year, you know, maybe next time we're at a con, we're going to have some reels taken. Yeah, we're old. That is not going to happen.
I'm old.
So next week, well, we've covered some of the worst stories around her. So now we're taking a more gentle look at the second female Robin, the fourth Batgirl, but the one and only spoiler, Stephanie Brown. We'd like to thank our Patreon backers, including our very first, Dan Grote.
That's me.
That's you.
Josh Wheel, Mrs. Abigail Hartbaum. Asimov Fangirl, Tony Thornley.
Go Utes.
Sam Hopper, John Wickham, Robert Secundus.
Bobby Two Bucks.
Tim Rooney, Georgios Reggioli, David Wheel, Alexander Wheel, Matt McThorne.
McThorny.
Dan Offer.
Barely knew her.
And Nate Randell. for their support. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at BatChatComics, and the show is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music / Audible, Podbean, and on ComicsXF.com, where new episodes drop every Thursday.
What the fuck is a Podbean?
Podbean is the new podcatcher that I'm using now that Google Podcasts is going away next week as we are recording this.
A Podbean. You people are crazy.
It was easily available on my phone, and so I just went with it. You can support the podcast on Patreon at patreon.com/batchatwithmattandwill, where you can get shout-outs, bonus content, pick a story, and even come on the show. If you want to hear more of my ramblings, mostly about the three C's, comics, cinema, and cats, you can follow me on Twitter and Blue Sky at MattLaz1013.
And I'm at Will Nevin. I'm never leaving Twitter, but I'm leaving this show to have a bowl of NyQuil for dinner. Good night, Huntsville!
And be sure to visit ComicsXF at ComicsXF.com or at ComicsXF on Blue Sky and Twitter for our weekly Friday Bat Chat roundup of new Bat books, for my other show, the ComicsXF Interview Podcast, where my longtime best friend and friend of the show, Dan Grote, and I interview comics creators, retailers, publishers, journalists, and other related tradespeople, as well as all the other stuff Will and I are writing. And stay safe out there, folks. Gotham is not a place to be after dark.